Heart of the Matter, where we slice up today's divisive political issues into bite-sized portions.
In other words, we discuss the issues in such a way that even your husband can understand.
The thing that separates us from the animals is our ability to accessorize.
Heart of the Matter is hosted by the Americhicks.
Men will be so excited.
Financial columnist Molly Vogt. Former financial advisor and current city councilwoman Kim Monson.
Frankly, they're a little racy for me.
There isn't any room at the top for local goyles like us.
Now, let's get to the heart of the matter on ATX Ask the Experts.
Hey, welcome to Heart of the Matter with the Americhicks, Molly and Kim. It is great to be with you this afternoon. And as you know, we talk about important issues and why you should be paying attention. We look at these things as right versus wrong instead of right versus left. And we tell real stories about real people and look for solutions and just all kinds of great conversations. So thank you for listening.
Yeah, and we would love to hear from you today. We've got some cool topics, but we would love your point of view on it. Call us 303-477-5600. And then please follow us on Facebook. We're the Americhicks. You can email us at americhicks@gmail.com. You can check out our website for some really cool new videos that are going up, which is americhicks.com. So check us out. We've got some new stuff coming out.
Well, definitely. So let's start off, though, with the what's on your radar. Molly, you've been having a couple of things that's on your heart right now. So what's the top one?
Well, I have a lot of things on my heart that I'm going to tell you all about. But first, I just want to say congratulations, Kim Monson. She just won the Leadership Program of the Rockies 2016 Leaders in Action Award this past weekend in Colorado Springs. Congratulations, Kim.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really an honor. I mean, that is, those are our peeps down there, people that care about liberty, freedom, the individual to be able to pursue their happiness. So it was really, really cool.
It was really cool, and especially because you opened for Kennedy, and she is just such an amazing. She's such a hilarious. I mean, she's politically just a genius. She's so right up on everything. She knows what's going on. She's a comedian. She's just hilarious the way that she gets things across, and she's pro freedom.
Yeah.
So I just think she's awesome, and so Kim's award opened for her, and so that was pretty cool. And then after that, Tommy Lehrer, who is on The Blaze, and I'm sure if y'all have seen her, check her out. Check out her YouTube video.
23 years old.
23 years old, beautiful blonde, freedom girl. She's on The Blaze. If you don't remember, she just took on Charlamagne, who was upset that she had made a comment about Beyonce's dance at the Super Bowl and doing the hands up to the Black Panthers and to Malcolm X. But so Tommy, we got to interview her, which was really cool. But then afterwards, she went home and did a show two nights ago and mentioned Kim Monson and had all of Kim's pictures up there saying, this makes me want to fight for liberty. This gives me hope, because obviously she's 23 years old and she's fighting the good fight for freedom. And she's looking at Kim going, wow, look what these women are doing in Colorado. She's got, Kim's taking on the city council to get Hooters to be able to open their business.
It's
a private property
yeah,
rights issue. And Kim stood up for them, and it was a really big deal. And I just think it's such a really cool big deal that Tommy was just talking about you on her TV show. So everybody, go to our website and check out the video. Please share it. Share it with your friends and comment. We'd love to get it out there.
We're
pretty proud of
great.
Kim.
And it was pretty funny. Molly and I have been up to Boulder with a group of women. Again, just trying to search out these ideas and look at things as right versus wrong instead of right versus left. Long day. Probably we'd been working 14 hours. And so Molly calls me. I'm on my hands-free phone. I just want you to know that.
Oh, of course, because you would never break the law.
Yeah. And she goes, Kim, you're on TV. And I'm like, what? And so it was a pretty cool deal. It was really cool. So, and then the other thing that's just great is LPR, Leadership Program of the Rockies, we just have to give a shout out. And anybody that is interested in freedom and putting that forward, they will be taking applications in August, I think it is, for next year. And they select 65 individuals. And that's where Molly and I met. And once you get to LPR, I said to everyone, fasten your seatbelts because you never know what's going to happen. But then that night, they have this free market competition where alumni are able to present, what they're doing and get support from other alumni. And it's a very competitive event, and there is actually some great prizes. And our own Molly Vogt won that. So it was an Americhix weekend down there at Leadership Program of the Rockies.
Thanks for the mention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was great. It was great to be able to talk to people about what we're doing. As you know, on the show, we look at things as left versus, as right versus wrong. And instead of left versus right.
As right versus left, yeah.
And so we want to spark conversations across party lines by people to talk about these political issues. Because there's so much going on in the news, and I know that it's so hard to keep up with it all. And sometimes you just go, it's just too much, I can't stand it, it's too scary, I give up, I quit. But it doesn't have to be that scary. Just if you tune into the AmeriChicks once a week and check out our website and check out our information, we're going to bring you the top articles, the top issues to start, just to make sure that you're thinking about and talking about with your friends and just walk it through and talk about it. You know, is this something the government should be looking at trying to fix, or is this something that we the people should be looking at fixing? And those are the kind of conversations we want to spark. So today we have invited our good buddy Tom Lucero to come into the studio with us and help us help us kind of work through the Electoral College, talk about the voting process, talk about what's going on right now. If anybody else is like me out there that didn't actually grow up in this political world, and I sit there and I look at the numbers on TV going, what's the difference between a caucus and a primary? I just don't understand. Why do some states do it this way and some do it this way? And, you know, I see that Trump and Hillary are in the lead right now. Are they always going to be in the lead? What does this mean? What's next? So we invited Tom to come in and talk about that.
Yeah, but we thought we'd ask him, what's on your radar, Tom?
Well, thank you very much for having me in studio, ladies. First off, what's your website? Because I wouldn't know where to go watch that video.
AmeriChicks.com.
AmeriChicks.com.
Thanks for asking.
You are welcome, because I'm sure listeners out there want to go to the website and figure that out. What is on my mind? Speaking of liberty, financial liberty. Right now, the headline on the Denver Post is Weld County energy jobs fading much faster than first thought. Oil and gas industry being heavily hit in the state of Colorado because of the prices. But as we know, a couple of ballot initiatives working their way through the Secretary of State's office that in essence will put the oil and gas industry out of business in the state of Colorado. Talk about economic liberty and hitting individuals who can least afford it, the elderly, the poor, and the middle class if energy costs go up in the state of Colorado. So pay attention to those ballot initiatives as they make their way through. Will they make it onto the ballot or won't they? If they do, it's going to be huge trouble for Colorado residents.
You know, Tom, it's a great point. An assault on reliable, efficient, and affordable energy is an assault on the way of life for Americans, for middle-class Americans, because as those prices go up, they're not going to be able, well, and I think the end game is the prices are going to get so high that it's really going to affect how people live their lives.
Absolutely. If you can't afford to pay your heating bills, you have to make trade-offs. What are those trade-offs? You're going to sit cold. You're not going to sit cold. Well, you're going to make the trade-off on food. You're going to make the trade-off on gas. It's trade-offs all across the board. Now, it's interesting because these initiatives don't ban hydraulic fracturing or actually put the energy industry out of business, but they so overly regulate them, they could, in fact, via regulation, put them out of business. It's a frightening thought.
It really is. So that's something we really need to keep our eye on.
Yeah, definitely. Especially, and I love that you're bringing it up as far as the economy is concerned. I know our friend Amy Oliver over at the Independence Institute shared a story with us recently about a woman here in Colorado whose electric bill has been just going up and up and up, and she's talking about what a large percentage of her income is going to go towards this. So she's sticking sticky notes all over the house on all the electrical outlets and the light switches and everything for her kids, saying, turn this off, unplug this. Everything needs to be off at all times. If you're not using it, turn it off, because we can't afford these electric bills going up. I mean, you know, the people that are going to be hurt the most with these rising electric bill are the most
vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So it seems like if we really care about people, we'd want to make sure that we have efficient, affordable, and reliable energy.
True. Yeah.
So
I've got another one, too. I don't know. Can I give you one?
Yeah,
another
you go ahead.
News radar.
Okay.
So this is a news radar. Okay. So as you know, we've been talking a lot about the refugees that are coming to America. Obviously, you know, they're flooding Germany, they're flooding all of these other areas. And, you know, these countries, we're taking them in because we want to help them. We're worried about what they're going through. We know that that life is literally really, really terrible right now where they live. But we want to make sure that we're vetting properly who we're bringing into the country to make sure that they're not going to try to hurt us. But we also need to make sure that we're paying attention to their medical needs. I just read an article from the Washington Examiner that says that the Obama administration is expanding the types of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, that he is going to allow into America.
What?
Yeah.
Yes.
You're kidding.
No.
I'm absolutely stunned.
Okay.
I don't even know what to say to that.
So, yeah. So they are reclassifying a few of these diseases to say they're not as bad as we thought they were. They were never really a big issue here in the United States over the past two decades. So we're going to say those are no longer considered a communicable disease of public health significance. So the problem, I think, is, yeah, it hasn't been a big problem in the United States for a reason. But these diseases still are a big problem in other countries.
Second and third world countries.
Second and third world countries.
Absolutely.
Who are we bringing in from where as refugees and coming across our border? People are coming in from second and third world countries. They're coming in with these diseases.
Yeah.
And then let me just say, in addition to that, we've got so many issues of rape taking place in these refugee resettlement camps, right? You're hearing all of the – it's happening in the camps as they're moving all around trying to get to their new countries. But it's also happening in the new countries where they get there. You look – you know, Sweden, Germany, you've got a refugee shelter in Belgium. Just now, a 16-year-old guy just raped one of the women that was working there helping them right after they did a class on how to properly treat women. Because they come from cultures where they don't believe that women are worth the same as men, and they believe that sexual abuse is okay, and it is their right. And then you have in Austria, an Iraq refugee, Iraqi refugee, he just raped a 10-year-old boy at a pool, at a public pool, saying it was a sexual emergency. So, A, I'm worried that these people are unfortunately come from a different culture than we do, and they're going to be possibly raping many, many more people, not just women, little boys and girls too. But also now that we're not worried about the STDs that they're bringing in and our government is going to do anything to try to get rid of those diseases before they let them loose in America. So that's on my radar. I'm worried about it.
Well, and let's remember, our Governor Hickenlooper agrees with President Obama in bringing the refugees not only into the United States, he has signed the state of Colorado up. So refugees will be coming to Colorado. I live in northern Colorado. We have three preferred cities on the list: Greeley, Loveland, and Fort Collins. Thank you to all of the politicians out there who will be bringing refugees into our community up in northern Colorado.
You know, Tom, it's of great concern, but I want to kind of look at this from the bigger picture. And I think this is something that Tommy said this last weekend, because when we have this conversation, you know, immediately there are those on the far left that say, you know, racist or, you know, Islamophobe or whatever. And I think it was Tommy that said this. She said, do you lock your doors at night? Tom, do you lock your
Absolutely.
Doors? Molly, do you lock your doors at night?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And she said, I do too. And she said, the reason I lock my doors is not because I dislike everybody outside. It's because I love everybody inside. And I think that's what we have to look at here in America. We have to make sure that we are loving our citizens. Our citizens are the most generous, the most innovative, the most free people in the world right now. And as long as we put that forward and protect them, then good things happen for the rest of the world as well. But if we continue, if we just left our doors open all the time and just let anybody come in and take whatever and make us pay for whatever, then eventually our homes and our lives will be at risk. So the reason we need to be concerned about this is not because we dislike people on that are not in America. It's because we love the people that are here.
Totally.
Well, and more selfishly for me, I have a daughter. I have a mom. I have cousins. And I don't want to see anything happen to those women.
Yeah.
and either of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Either.
Well, it's a perfect combination of the two things together.
Yes.
One, the fact that they're coming from these second and third world countries that have these diseases that we've not had to worry about for a while. And the other, that unfortunately their culture does tell them that it's okay to grab somebody off the street that they don't know yet, that they haven't taken on a date, that they don't have a relationship with, and just do what they want. So,
and another point on that, because people always talk about the great migration from Europe, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, which many of us, our ancestors, came over at that particular time. People came to Ellis Island, and they had to go through medical tests or whatever, and people were turned around and sent back if you know, they had a communicable disease. And so the idea that we are going to open our borders to this kind of a situation and have to pay for that, that is the other thing that regarding the Great Migration, late 1800s, early 1900s, is that was not a government program. People came in, they had maybe relatives or sponsors, that it was not a government program where once they got here, now, and I know for a fact that they get energy assistance, rent assistance, cash assistance, medical care, all kinds of things. And that, you know, Tom, that is antithetical to, I think, even a Christian ideal. If, in fact, we are going to help our fellow man, that doesn't mean that I go over here, if I'm going to help Molly, and I want to help Molly, I should help Molly. Instead, what's going on is, I'd like to help Molly, but I'm going to take your stuff and make you give it to her. And that is not what America was built on.
Well, and you're not only telling him to give me 100% of his stuff, you're saying give your stuff to the government. They're going to take half of it, and then they will slowly, over time, eventually get it to me, and I'm going to be totally bled out by the time the care gets there anyway.
Probably true.
So if you want something done, do it yourself.
Right.
And not to digress, since we're here to talk about caucus and electoral politics, right now in the state of Colorado, just so you know, Medicaid entitlement funding now consumes 40% of the state's general fund budget. 20% of Coloradoans are on Medicaid or some form of entitlement funding program, and then we're going to bring these refugees into our state. Guess who's going to pick up the tab?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
We are.
We have enough people hurting. We need to take care of our own first.
Right.
Absolutely.
You can't take care of somebody else if you're sick. You've got to make sure you put that oxygen mask on yourself first in the airplane before you help the guy next to you. We need to get our stuff in order here in America, get our people off the streets, get our people back to working again, get this economy booming again, and then we can afford to help other people. But right now, we just can't afford it. It's going to drag us down further, and we haven't been out of this recession really since 2008.
Well, Molly, Molly, to that point, if we are not healthy, then we cannot help anybody. I mean, it's in a way, it's almost over. So anyway, with that, though, Tom, we invited you in to talk about the Electoral College. And it is actually a fascinating subject. I've heard a number of people, again, it seems like from the far left, are saying we need to get rid of the Electoral College. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't quite understand what it is exactly. So do you want to take it from kind of square one?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting you say that, Kim, because we don't teach what anymore in high school or really in college. We don't teach basic civics.
Mm-hmm.
We need Americans to understand why the Electoral College is so important. So if we think about the brilliance of the American founding, which was democracy plus representative government plus the judiciary, the founding fathers were absolutely brilliant. So we get our congressmen, plus each state gets equal representation in the United States Senate. Then they were left with the question, how do we elect a president of the United States? The conclusion was your congressman and your two United States senators actually cast the votes, the representational votes for president of the United States. So in the state of Colorado, pop question, how many votes for president do we get? Pop
Nine.
Quiz. Nine. Yes. Why?
Let's see. Because we have two senators. Now, it's not the actual senators. We
correct.
Get,
correct.
Right,
correct.
So
in representation to the number of congressional representatives, and obviously every state has two senators.
Right. Two senators, and we have five congressmen. I mean, seven. I knew it. So, 5 + 2 = 9.
So in a state like Wyoming, where they have one congressman and two senators.
Three.
They have three. Exactly. So really what happens in November, the popular vote, and my kids can answer this because we talk civics around the dinner table, we aren't casting votes necessarily for Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, since we don't know who's going to be on the ballot this November. We're actually casting votes for 9 people to go represent us in December. Those 9 individuals will cast votes for President of the United States. Each party in the state of Colorado, Republican Party, which I am a member of, our party leadership will select 9 individuals to go represent us in December to go cast their votes for President of the United States. Should Republicans win, the Republican nominee, if they win the state of Colorado, those 9 individuals will go back east and cast the 9 votes for that person. Same with Democrats.
Okay. So it is important, though, which candidate wins Colorado, because those 9 electoral votes will be cast for that particular candidate. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. But not necessarily. You bring up an interesting point. Do the delegates, the 9 electoral delegates from the state of Colorado, are they legally obligated to cast their vote for the person that they are supposed to cast their vote for?
I say no.
No. In fact, actually, it has happened. And actually, very recently, but here's where it typically happens. When the Republican wins, Democrat electoral voters from across the country who were not happy with their party will actually cast dissenting votes for the individual they thought should be the nominee, and vice versa for Republicans. So in 1976, after Gerald Ford won, lost to Jimmy Carter, a number of Republicans who went back east and cast their vote for Ronald Reagan because they thought Ronald Reagan should have been the nominee and not Gerald Ford.
Now, if in fact
So Jimmy Carter beats Gerald Ford, I said that entirely backwards.
Okay.
Yep. I am known to do that.
I just
make stuff up, Kim, and it sounds really good because I say it so authoritatively.
Well, you did. I think I can follow you. So I'm working on that. Okay.
Yes.
So what you're saying, though, is if in fact, say, Colorado would have gone to Carter.
Yes.
Okay. But in essence, the 9 electoral votes for the Republican, just kind of to say neener, 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 they voted for Reagan instead.
Well, the 9 Colorado electoral votes would have gone to Jimmy Carter. Democrats would have sent their 9 back east.
Okay.
Let's say Wyoming, for example.
Okay.
Their 3, Ford wins Wyoming. Okay. So there are 3 electoral votes from Wyoming.
For Ford.
Yep. Those 3 say, you know what, it should have been Reagan. We're actually going to cast our votes for Reagan instead of Ford.
So they don't even have to vote within their party.
Okay. No.
But they have to be registered within the party.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And typically they're party loyalists, people who have given a lot of money, people who've been active and volunteering for the party. It's a reward. It's a tremendous honor to be selected as one of the 9 to represent your party in casting a vote for president.
Okay. Now, Tom, let's back this up just a little bit, because I did just some research on the Electoral College. And this was something that was very important to the founders, because they understood a lot of people. I hear people say that we are a democracy. America is not a democracy. It's a democratic a constitutional republic, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, and the reason that that is important is because with a democracy, one man, one vote, you can actually have what's called the tyranny of the majority.
Yes.
And we've given this example, but it's, say there's 3 of us here, and we all have a vote, and you and I could vote to throw Molly out the window,
That was rhetorical. You didn't want me to actually vote on that because I raised my hand.
Watch me fly. Yeah. You guys, the joke's on you. I brought my cape today.
So, but with that, in fact, that was a Democratic vote. The majority ruled. However, that stomps all over Molly's right to life, liberty, and happiness. And so in order to try to protect that, the tyranny of the majority, as you say, the founders was always trying to figure out a way to make sure that they protected Molly from you and I doing that to her.
Absolutely. Representative government. And at that point in time, you also have to remember, senators were not selected by popular vote. Senators were selected at the state legislature. So our closest representation was our representatives to the Capitol and our representatives to the House of Representatives, intentionally created so that we could have that close interaction. The U.S. Senate disparate in the sense that it was, quote unquote, that deliberative body. But again, one step even removed from that was selection of the President of the United States to provide those protections in the Constitution from what you just described, Kim.
Okay. Now, another thing that I understand about the Electoral College, it was put in place so that, in fact, the smaller states, from a population standpoint, would not be totally overrun by the bigger states, such as, in this case, California and New York.
Texas, Florida, Ohio, the big states, yes.
If all of those votes from a popular standpoint went to a particular candidate without the Electoral College, then Wyoming, Colorado, all of these other states, it might not matter. But if, in fact, that they felt that, and somebody told me this example, that with Florida, and I think it was the Gore-Bush, that, in fact, the smaller states kind of banded together because they felt like they were getting ramrodded by, some of the bigger states. And so then Florida coming into play was so important.
And let's remember that, because that is critically important, the 2000 election. Al Gore won the popular vote by 540,000 votes. He lost in the Electoral College because of what you just described, the state of Florida. If you look at those population centers that you just described, California, New York, the very liberal population centers, they would have more control over the outcome of a presidential election than any other place in the country.
That is, and I'm going to tee this up, and then we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes. But the danger that I see with that, Tom, is as we've moved away from federalism, where in essence, the states are supposed to be sovereign, they kind of run themselves, and that the federal government is limited, and that the federal government only does things that are for the general welfare, for everybody in the country. So let's say California makes a whole bunch of bad financial decisions.
let's just stretch our imaginations
yes.
and think that.
Okay, just roll with me on this, okay?
Uh-huh.
So let's say that they make a whole bunch of bad financial decisions, and in fact, because of their population numbers, they have they're able to affect the presidential election, and so they might be looking for a bailout for those bad decisions. I see some risk if we didn't have the Electoral College that all the rest of us would have to pay for that. So with that, why don't you keep that thought? When we come back from break, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that, Tom Lucero and Molly Vogt. This is Molly Vogt and Kim Munson, and we'll be right back. April 15th. You know what day that is. Leonardo da Vinci's birthday. He was born in Italy in 1452. Oh yeah, and it's tax day, the favorite day of socialists and the least liked day by hardworking Americans. It's important that you work with trusted individuals for all of your accounting needs and tax preparation. Hi, Kim Munson here. The Americhicks work with a truly professional accounting firm, Predovich & Company. The team at Predovich & Company can help with all of your accounting needs, individual, business, or nonprofit. Give them a call at 303-791-3000 or check out their website at dpredovich.com. That's dpredovich.com. And be sure and tell them the Americhick sent you.
And when it's done, believe it, I will yell it from that mountain high.
the Heart of the Matter with the AmeriChicks. Molly and Kim here, and we are getting to the heart of the matter on election season and Electoral College, and what does that mean? It's extremely confusing to me, but I am just so thankful that we are a constitutional republic and not a democracy. Because if we were, as we were saying, as Kim said before we went to break, California, my goodness, if just the amount of people that they have in California voting, they could vote to take away all of our stuff. Mm-hmm. Like they're doing to their own people right now. But mm-hmm. hey, that's why I don't live in California. No offense. I have a lot of good friends that live there. It's a beautiful place state. To live. But they're just, you know.
Beautiful
place to visit. There you go. But yeah, I want to hold on to my money. I work hard for it. So Tom Lucero is in studio with us, and he is giving us the rundown on this whole voting deal in the Electoral College.
Yeah, and Kim had a great question as we were heading into break. What would happen if we went with a popular vote? Because there are those on the left who want to do away with the Electoral College. What does that mean for those of us in Colorado? We have gotten used to the idea of being branded a purple state. Because of the Electoral College. Sometimes we swing Republican, sometimes we swing Democrat. That's why we receive so much attention from the presidential campaigns. What happens if we go to a popular vote? No presidential candidate will ever visit the state of Colorado again, the state of Wyoming, the state of New Mexico, state of Nevada, state of Arizona. They will stay in California, they will stay in New York, they'll stay in Texas, Florida, Ohio. That is pretty much it. And to Kim's point, if California delivers, and we know California would deliver for the Democrat, guess where those political favors are going to be repaid to? California. But let's also think about this in terms of what about voter fraud? If you have a popular vote, what are you going to do? You're going to go to the states that are more likely to go your way, and you're going to stuff the ballot box in California. Why wouldn't you? With the Electoral College, we can keep an eye on voter fraud across the country. It brings it back down to the people as they are voting.
Right, right.
So because we do the Electoral College instead of a popular vote, why is it important for people to get up on voting day and actually vote?
Because you are voting for one of your 9 representatives in your state to go cast your vote for you for president. All voting's important. And it's interesting because as we talk about the complications of the Electoral College, Molly, one of the things that people need to always remember, the famous quote of Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. You have your greatest impact at the local level. In fact, if we get a second, we should talk about caucus coming up here on March 2nd, but the opportunity to impact elections at the school board level, at the city council level, for the state representative, for your state representative, forget about the presidential, just cast that vote while you're there. But if you really want to impact politics locally, that's where you do it on election day, because those, again, as we were talking about earlier, those are the people closest to you. You can literally pick up the phone and call your state representative, your city council member, your school board member, and guess what? They'll call you back, your state senator. You're not going to pick up the phone and get Cory Gardner on the phone anymore or Michael Bennett, and you're certainly not going to get the president of the United States on the phone.
Now, Tom, just clarifying, I was thinking that caucus is the first. Is it Tuesday the 1st, or am I mixed up on my days?
Yes, next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday the 1st.
I hope so. That's what I've got on my calendar.
Okay, great.
It's kind of important that I know when it is.
And why don't you just tell us quickly why?
Because I am running for the state legislature, House District 51 up in Loveland. And if people want to get more information, they just go to luceroforcolorado.com.
Okay, and I don't think that we really shared this, but you're pretty, you've been involved for a long time. You're a former regent of the University of Colorado, right? You served that for 12 years. And you've been in Colorado since 1988. You're a businessman, you're an entrepreneur, so you really bring a lot to the table.
Born and raised in Colorado.
Oh.
Got active. My first presidential election, 1998 for H.W. Bush, when I was a student down in Durango.
Okay.
Fort Lewis College.
Okay. And okay, got it.
Yes.
I put down 1980. I'm not doing very good with numbers today, you guys. You know, there's just
I've got some more pop questions for you.
Do you? Okay.
Get her. All right, what's next?
Okay. So so with that though, I wanted to just go back a little bit. It's such an interesting conversation. But the Electoral College is constitutional, right?
Yes.
It's established in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. So you know, as we look at the vision of the Declaration, all men are created equal and have inalienable rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, then the Constitution puts in place the protections to make sure that that happens. The founders thought that the Electoral College was so important that they put that in place. And just to kind of re-clarify and summarize, is that is to protect the individual against the tyranny of the democracy, the tyranny of the majority. And so they thought it was so important that they put it into the Constitution. So all those on the far left that want to get rid of the Electoral College, it would have to be an amendment to the Constitution, right?
No. Oh. Interesting point, Kim. A number of states, including the state of Arizona right now, which has moved a bill through the legislature back to the federalism piece of it. Remember, 50 right? states get the opportunity to go out there with 50 different experiments. You do not necessarily need to amend the Constitution to go to a popular vote. You can get individual states to say, we no longer want to participate in the Electoral College. We want to go to a popular vote. In fact, the state of Nebraska, interestingly enough, they have divided based on popular vote, the electoral votes. Electoral votes in Nebraska as a percentage of votes cast in Nebraska. So it's not winner take all in Nebraska. Nebraska sends a few delegates for the Republican and a few delegates for the Democrat.
And it'll be the percentage of the popular vote
there. Absolutely. There are ways and there are groups and organizations out there trying to move us to a popular vote, which is very bad for individuals like us in the state of Colorado. Small states, back to what you were saying earlier, Kim.
Well, and the other component, Molly, did you have any other questions on this? Because I kind of wanted to move over to voting and the responsibility of voting. Did you have anything else?
Well, you know, I've got questions just based on what's going on right now, like what we're seeing in the news with the caucuses that have taken place thus far. And, you know, We've got Clinton in the lead for all except for one state. Trump's in the lead for all except for one state. And I'm just kind of wondering what that means. And also superdelegates versus delegates, because you're mentioning these delegates, but that they don't have to vote for who the people tell them to vote for. But when we saw with the Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders deal, the popular vote wanted Bernie, but the superdelegates voted for Hillary.
Yes.
So that kind of confused me. Can you kind of just explain? I know I've got a lot going on here.
Let's separate
the super delegates versus delegates.
Let's separate two things, though, quickly. Electoral delegates are delegates selected in November. What we're talking about, or what I believe you want to talk about, mm-hmm. are delegates being selected in caucus and primary right. states going on right now,
right.
who will then go to the convention and select and vote on their nominee.
Exactly, because I'm confused with what's happening right now.
So, interesting fact, the Republican Party does not have superdelegates. Only the Democrat side has superdelegates. So
okay.
what you saw in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders should have walked away from New Hampshire with more delegates than Hillary Clinton.
Right.
But the way the Democrat Party insulates itself and has their hands on who their nominee is going to be, they've created a system of superdelegates made up of elected officials and other individuals who have the freedom to cast their delegate vote any way they want when they get to the convention. And guess what? Hillary Clinton is part of the Democrat establishment. She lined up all of the endorsements. She has all of the support from the superdelegates. So even though Bernie Sanders won the popular vote and should have walked away from New Hampshire with more delegates, he didn't.
But it's so strange to me, because doesn't the Democratic Party basically run on the fact that they want every human being to have a voice, that they want to be representative of all the people? But what they're doing in putting together these superdelegates, they are saying the people are too stupid to pick them on their own. We've already picked who we want, so we're going to make sure our guy goes in or our woman gets picked, regardless of what the people choose.
You summarized it brilliantly.
So it's big government. Big government is making the decision,
yes,
not the people.
The big party establishment, yeah, on the Democrat side.
Wow.
Now, on the Republican side, we do not have superdelegates, so it is a much fairer representation. Here's where it gets a little bit tricky, Molly. We have not had a winner-take-all contest yet. So in Iowa, because Ted Cruz won Iowa, Donald Trump finished in second, you had to clear a threshold of 20%. Anybody in Iowa who received 20% or more of the votes received proportionally a share of Iowa's delegates. Same in South Carolina, except in South Carolina, the way they divvy it up is by congressional district and then overall statewide vote. So Donald Trump actually won every congressional district in South Carolina. Nevada, same thing, proportional delegate handout or assignment or win, however you want to define it. So right now, Marco Rubio actually had the smartest statement of any of the candidates. I believe it was yesterday when he said, "We're not chasing votes, we're chasing delegates." And right now, Donald Trump is in the lead in the delegate count on the Republican side. He only has 80 delegates. I believe Ted Cruz has 16, Marco Rubio has 14, and then the others have the remaining few delegates. So in reality, Donald Trump's lead is 80 delegates to 16 to 14. It's not states. It's not popular vote. Texas, again, will divvy theirs up proportionally. Where it gets to be big is in Florida, and as we begin to move to winner-take-all states. All you have to do is win by one vote, and if you win by one more vote than your opponent, you will win all of the delegates from that state.
Okay. So just clarifying, though, Electoral College, what we're talking about, is in the Constitution, and that is something after November that those votes will be cast.
In December.
In December at that time. Now we've moved over to what's happening currently, and that is the competition for delegates from each of these states. And now next Tuesday is caucus, and my understanding is caucus is really a word for meeting, where you will come together with your neighbors, you will meet, and you will decide who you want to send to the assemblies, right?
County assembly, state assembly, and congressional assemblies. And as we were talking earlier about the power of your vote, why do you vote? Why do you vote in November? Because you want all politics to be local. You want to have a voice at the local level. Your vote counts more on March 1st than it does at any other point in time, because the people who will be selecting on the Republican and Democrat side who they want to represent them on the primary ballot, who they want their delegates to be to go to Cincinnati for the Republican convention. I have no idea where the Democrat convention is. Do either of you?
Mm-mm.
Tampa, California, who knows? Anyhow, those delegates are going to be selected in living rooms all across the state of Colorado on March 1st. Though you are empowering individuals to go speak on your behalf, as long as, let's qualify this, as long as you are a registered Republican or Democrat, because we have a closed system in Colorado, unaffiliateds cannot participate, and you cannot cross over if you're a Republican and participate with Democrats and vice versa. Your vote matters more on March 1st than any other time in the election process.
Yeah, that's huge. We will repeat that several times. What about if you're registered unaffiliated right now? Can you register like tomorrow, just as long as by March 1st you're registered Republican or Democrat to vote in that caucus?
Unlike our state legislature, it saw fit in its infinite wisdom a couple of years ago to pass same-day voter registration, Molly, the answer to that question is no. In order to participate in caucus, you had to have been registered. I believe it was either 45 days ago or 60 days ago. But the bottom line is, if today you are not registered a Republican or a Democrat, you cannot participate on March 1st in caucus.
Okay.
You know, Tom, that brings up a question. This is Kim here. I understand that there is an organization out there called Building a Better Colorado, and they really have three things that they're focusing on. One of them is they're trying to get around Tabor. But another of those things is that to allow open primaries, where, in fact, what Molly just asked, where unaffiliateds could vote in either the Republican or the Democratic caucuses. What's your opinion on that?
I feel very personally about that because I am a lifelong Republican, have participated in the caucus process since 1992, have been a delegate to state and county and congressional, a candidate myself. I take it very personally. That's my party. And the individuals who take it seriously enough to show up on March 1st for caucus night, we feel very passionately about our party. We don't want outside groups coming in and trying to meddle with our nominating process, picking the individuals that the Republican Party would like to see on the ballot. So I feel very strongly about the fact that Democrats and unaffiliated voters should not be able to participate in our selection process. And I would assume Democrats feel very strongly that they don't want Republicans or unaffiliated voters meddling in their process either.
Right. And if someone wants to take part in the caucus process, all they have to do is register Democrat or Republican by the date. I think, what was that, three weeks ago or so?
Yeah, or 3 or 4 weeks ago. Yeah.
Something like that. Now, that brings up the next thing on voting. And we all understand that the right to vote is, it's really a sacred responsibility. But, you know, I continue to see different videos out there, maybe talk to individuals that say, you know, I need to vote. But then I may ask just a couple of basic questions. Like, I saw a video of a gal on a college campus where she was asking questions such as who won the Civil War, and college students couldn't give her the answer. Just some questions like that. But then they asked, who was Brad Pitt married to, and they knew. Who is he married to now, and they knew. And my point on this is that I think that there is a responsibility to know what's going on if you're going to vote. Now, we may not all agree on something, but I think there's a sacred responsibility to know what is going on. And so people might come in and they might say, I like the way Molly vote looks, although Molly may vote all the time to take away everybody's rights.
That is so nice of you.
Yeah.
I only heard part one. As we Molly's candidacy for the United States Senate.
Part of that. Yeah.
But I think that it's important that people understand the character of you know, who they're voting for and what this American idea is about and how important it is that each citizen, you know, understand freedom.
Yeah, I agree. And I kind of have in my mind a solution to that, although I know there are many reasons that it won't work. But it would be great if when people voted, there wasn't an R or a D beside the names. I think it would be amazing if people, they looked at the name, they said, okay, there's this person running and this person running. I don't know what they stand for because I don't see a letter by their name. So I'm going to go on the internet and I'm going to do some research. What issues does this person care about? What are their solutions? What are their strategies? What do they think that we need to do to solve this, this, or this? Who are they beholden to? What do they believe in? What is their character? That is how we would get people to actually start paying attention before they vote.
I wish I had your optimism, Molly. And by the way, I do not know who Brad Pitt's first wife is.
Jennifer Aniston.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Who was the first president of the United States?
George Washington.
There you go. He's back.
Yes, exactly. Because the reality of it is, and I have seen the data, the average voter. So we hear the phrase all the time, low information voter. What does that really mean? I'll define it for you. That is the individual who spends less than 6 minutes as we get into October and ballots, early ballots start to arrive at the mailbox, less than 6 minutes of time researching who they are going to vote for president of the United States. No. I don't think removing the R or the D actually is going to compel them to spend half hour, 45 minutes, an hour actually doing the research needed.
Right. I know. But, you know, it's just I've heard from so many people that I've asked in the past, say, 5 years since I finally woke up and said, wow, what is the government doing that's affecting my life? I had no clue before. And I asked my friends, you know, who do you vote for? What do you care about? Republican, Democrat? And they're like, oh, you know, I'm always this party because my parents were this party and my grandparents are this party. And so I'm always going to vote this party. It doesn't matter the issue. It doesn't matter what the person cares about. It doesn't matter what's going on. But the problem with that is that parties change. Parties have changed significantly over the years. And so you can't just vote party line anymore. I think it's so important to say, let's look at the issues that are the most important things that we're facing today, right now in America. And as you know, Kim and I do these women's groups, and so many women are concerned about the safety of America, of their community, of what's taking place with the refugees coming in and the borders being open. People are concerned about education. You know, we've got moms that say, I've got kids that are coming home from school, and they are saying something totally opposite of what I taught them, of what we talked about what our family believes in. They're making up their own history. Apparently, there's one history book some kids can bring home, and there's one that they have to leave in class in certain schools. And so these are things that people are concerned about. So what they should be doing is going online and doing the research and saying, okay, if I want to make sure that my schools are beholden to me, not the federal government, I want to make sure I know what's going on in here, then I'm going to make sure that I'm electing people that are going to give me school choice and transparency. And, you know, if I'm concerned about safety, I want to bring somebody in that actually knows something about foreign policy, that knows something about self-defense, that knows something about our military, maybe has had some expertise there and some history there that actually is going to try to protect our families. So, I mean, I get it. But I'm just saying to people out there, please don't just vote party line all the time based on what your parents and grandparents did or what your friends at school are telling you that they're doing. Do your own research, because it's
not. And listen to the heart of the matter.
We just want to spark conversations across party lines. Mm-hmm. It's not right versus left.
But
it's
you
right
said something interesting, Molly, and you really drove the point home. The two big issues is you and Kim are out there talking to people, security mm-hmm. and education.
Right.
Two most important elected bodies in your community.
Right.
The school board and the city council can do more to protect you from a security standpoint and educate the next generation of leaders in our communities. All politics is local. That's why it's so critically important. If you don't know who your school board member is, your city council representative, your mayor, pick up the phone and give them a call. Mm-hmm. Get to know those individuals. Get engaged in the process.
Yeah. Yeah. People say that they're not into politics because they don't like politics. Well, I hate politics. And that's why I started paying attention, because politics loves to make pass policies that affect my life,
mm-hmm.
take away my money, and take away my right to health care, take away my options with health care, and raise prices on everything I have to buy. So you know what? I hate politics. That's why I'm paying a lot more attention.
You may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you.
Yeah. In a negative way, unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
We have not minded the shop, Republican or Democrat, and I will take issue, and that's why I love your tagline, ladies. Try saying that three times very quickly. Because Republicans have also, quote unquote, sinned in that matter, growing government, taking liberties and taking rights away,
yeah.
just as Democrats. And there are good Democrats out there who are fighting bigger government as well. We need to recognize those individuals, too.
Mm-hmm. And that's why elections really do count. You put somebody in there that you thought was going to do a good job, that you met face-to-face and said, okay, you've got my vote, I trust you, and then they go to Washington and they do something completely opposite, you vote them out.
Yes.
Elections have consequences. We need to hold our elected leaders responsible.
And that means
hold their feet to the fire.
And that means we have to be engaged.
Yeah.
Every citizen has a responsibility to be engaged. So we are coming to the end of the show. Tom Lucero, thank you so much for being in studio and sharing your great understanding of the Electoral College and the voting process. And again, how can people get information about you and what are you doing?
Running for the state legislature, House District 51, Lucero for Colorado.com. Ladies, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. And with that, the quote of the day, Tom, we always like to do something maybe historical, maybe current, but here it's regarding the Electoral College. The authors of the Constitution had studied the history of many failed democratic systems, and they strove to create a different form of government. Indeed, James Madison, delegate from Virginia, argued that unfettered majorities, such as those found in pure democracies, tend toward tyranny. Madison stated it this way: In a pure democracy, common passion or interest will, in almost every case, be felt by a majority of the whole. A communication and concert results from the form of government itself, and there is nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice the weaker party or an obnoxious individual. Hence it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or rights of property, and have in general been in short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths.
Wow.
Wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, stay with us because the next hour we are going to be talking about Apple versus the FBI, privacy versus security, and very, very curious is what to what you all think out there. We'd love to hear from you, so call in on that one as well. We're going to have somebody from the Heritage Institute with us talking about those details too. But it's a big one, you know. We want to be able to protect the people. We want to protect our communities. We want to make sure that the government can get the bad guys. We also want to make sure the government doesn't have unlimited access to all of our information, even though I really thought that they already did.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really good conversation on that also.
It is. Especially yeah. The fact that here it is Apple that is that's the one that's trying to protect our rights, considering that's why I left them previously, because they were letting everybody's information out into the public. So
with that, just remember that we lock our doors at night, not because we dislike everybody outside, but because we love everybody inside. Hey, welcome to Heart of the Matter with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. We are excited to have you tune in with us this afternoon, and just love these great conversations. We look at issues and why they should be on our radar today. We look at these issues as right versus wrong instead of right versus left. And we tell stories of real people experiencing real things and looking at solutions to try to fix it together. So thank you for listening to the conversation.
Yeah, and join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you, 303-477-5600. And then follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are the AmeriChicks. You can check out our website at AmeriChicks.com. We have a lot of great new videos up. We've done a lot of great interviews in the past couple of weeks. So go check those out. Also, Kim Munson is up there. Tommy Lahren, I believe is her last name. She's has her own show on The Blaze, and she just did her segment last night on Kim Munson. So check that one out. And then listen to us. We're live 1 to 3 on Thursdays, but we rebroadcast our shows again. We're so thankful that KLZ is doing that for us. Thursday night, 6 to 7, Saturday, 4 to 6 a.m., and Sundays, 5 to 6 p.m. So tune into those. And, of course, all of our old podcasts are available on our website, AmeriChicks.com.
Yes. And Molly, I need to do a little housekeeping issue. And if Justin is out there listening right now, I understand that you had called in to clarify something regarding the caucus process here in Colorado, that there has been a change that has been made where delegates are not beholden, that they're not required to vote for, I think, who they said they do were going to a caucus. But Justin, I think that you could clarify that. And I know that there are some people that are very concerned about that. So I think that we need to clarify that also on the website. So we'll go to work on that, Molly. So, but Justin, if you're out there still listening, we would appreciate you calling back on that, even though we're going to be moving to another subject. If you call in, we're going to stop and clarify that, if that's okay with you. Oh, Justin, that's great. Hey, is this David?
Hello.
Is this Justin?
This is Justin. How are you, ladies?
Hey,
doing?
Justin, great. Thanks for calling back, and sorry that we missed your call in that first hour. So, go ahead. It sounds like you've got an understanding of something that's a little new in Colorado.
Yes. It's you were just discussing the caucus process in your last hour, and the caucus is coming up here in Colorado. And in the main, your guest was absolutely right. That is typically how a caucus works. That's how a primary works. That when a state holds either a caucus or a primary for their respective party, what happens is the people of the state go in and they vote for whom they want to be their presidential candidate. And then that state, depending upon the outcome, will send its delegates to the national convention based upon the choice of their voters. Now, the state party chairman of the Colorado Republican Party has decided that this year that will not be the case, that no matter whom the Republican voters of Colorado vote for on Tuesday, that the delegates that are sent to the national convention this summer can vote however they want. So to say that another way, if 100% of the voters of Colorado, the Republican voters from Colorado, say that they want Marco Rubio to be their candidate. The delegates from Colorado can go to the convention this summer, and every single one of them can cast their vote for Ted Cruz or for Donald Trump.
Okay. So
effectively, the voters in the Republican voters in Colorado have been disenfranchised because it doesn't matter how they vote. The delegates can vote however they choose.
Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that when you're picking your delegates, you pick somebody that you really do trust.
Well, that's really what it comes down to this year. And that's a little more complex aspect of the process.
Right.
Is it really is this year about picking the person who's going to be the delegate rather than voting for a candidate here in Colorado? And I don't think, unfortunately, there's going to be enough time or enough exposure for most Colorado Republican voters to have the opportunity to make sense of that.
Okay. And Justin, need to quickly move to the next thing, but I just want to get your read on that. Why do you think that this change was made? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, actually, the Republican Party, I can only paraphrase because it's been a while since I read the report, but the Republican Party chairman actually came out and said effectively that the reason that the party has decided this is because typically in a caucus year, they get a small number of Republican voters who will come to a caucus. He said this year, because of anti-establishment candidates, there are so many people who are taking an interest in this campaign that the campaign will be disproportionately swayed by all of the new people coming to vote. So effectively what he's saying is that they want to maintain the centralized power that the established party has.
Wow. Okay. Well, Justin, thank you for calling back on that, and we really appreciate that. We actually are going to move on because we want to talk about Apple, the FBI, the Fourth Amendment, and we have David and Sarah from the Heritage Foundation with us. So thank you so much for calling in, but I'd like to just give you a little information. This whole Apple, FBI, Patriot Act, Fourth Amendment, these are really big questions, Molly, and they're very important questions. And so we're very excited to have David and Sarah with us. He is a policy analyst in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy, and he specializes in homeland security issues, including cyber and immigration policy and protection of the critical infrastructure. So I think he probably knows a lot about this subject, so I am so excited to chat with him. So, David, are you there?
I am. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you. So, could you tee this up for us? What is going on with Apple and the FBI?
Yeah, so what's going on here is that we have two very important, I think, competing security priorities. In the case of the FBI wants to gain access to a phone, an iPhone, which has information on the San Bernardino attackers and some of their communications, or it may contain valuable information on their plotting. That's clearly a core national interest of the federal government, is to prevent terrorism and to keep its people safe from acts of terrorism. On the other hand, we have Apple, who's saying that if we do this thing that you want for us, this breaking down of the protections of our that we've built into our iPhones, if we break down those security protections, this could lead to greater consequences and greater harms in terms of how secure our devices are. And so what I see is two very important issues that the American people should care about: stopping terrorism and keeping their own data, keeping themselves safe in the cyber domain. But in this case, it seems like those are competing, and it doesn't seem like there's an answer that neatly allows us to have both, and that's what the debate is about.
So let me ask you this, David. Molly here. Thanks for joining us. Couldn't the government just ask Apple to go in and tell them, just specifically on those iPhones for these San Bernardino shooters, ask them for the information, for the phone calls, for the messages, the text messages, the emails, and all of that, just on those phones, so that Apple gets that information for them and does not necessarily put together some new algorithm or something specifically for the government so that the government can see everything of ours?
And so there's a couple problems with that, and the first is that the way that, first of all, they actually do have access to some of the information, like, for instance, which calls were made. They have some access to metadata. They can get that from the telephone company and stuff like that. But the problem is they can't unlock or they can't get through the protection of the encryption on just one phone. If you create Apple, on these newer devices, every time Apple comes out with a new iPhone, it's been continually improving the security of its devices, improving the protections it includes on its devices. And when it improves these devices, though, it means that only you, the consumer who owns the iPhone, is able to unlock it. And that's the point that we've reached, where the ability to unlock the phone remotely does not reside in Apple anymore. And so the FBI can't just say, hey, can you help us out on this one thing? You don't have to build anything. No, the FBI needs Apple to build a new set of technology, a new software tool that bypasses those protections in order to get access to the information on that phone. So that's the problem. It doesn't seem like it can be a solution just for this phone. It's going to be a solution that will work on all or most iPhone 5Cs, and that's where the rub kicks in.
But so are you saying then that even Apple can't go into their own system and find these email messages and locate them right now? You're saying they can't even do that. They've built this protection so good, so strong, that Apple can't even get this information.
Indeed. And Apple create, and when we talk about encryption and backdoors, things like that, right now it's important to realize that properly encrypted information cannot be broken by almost anyone. Properly encrypted information is very secure, and the way Apple has designed its phones is that the encryption can only be cracked by the passcode that you, the user of the iPhone, have. And some people also use their thumbprints, but that's not relevant in this case. So the passcode is absolutely critical in this case, which is why what Apple is asking, or sorry, what the Department of Justice is asking of Apple is that we need you to help take down some of the protections that you've built around the passcode. That way we can, it's called brute forcing, that way we can guess every single combination. And we can guess every single combination of numbers of passwords, then we'll be able to get into the device and figure out what's on there. So, yeah, right now Apple is not able to do that unless it breaks down those protections, which it cannot do right now.
Okay, now David, it's Kim here. We had talked to a good friend of ours who has his MBA in computer science, a systems programmer, and he said that any programmer, systems programmer worth their salt, would always have a back door, but that perhaps Apple does not want to admit that because, one of their marketing strategies, I guess it would be, is that things are so secure. So in acknowledging that could be, that there is a back door, could be antithetical to what they've actually been telling the consumer. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that could be a possibility, but I think in this case, from reading, from thinking about where this came about, this whole move by Apple was largely brought about by the revelations that were Snowden, and so the result of this is that we're seeing an increased push toward everyone wanting to hide data to make sure that it can't be seen by the government, and so I think this is part of that. And so I actually do believe Apple when they say we've designed this system in such a way that right now we do not hold the back door. We can no longer access it. They've published many white papers telling, these white papers were specifically designed for law enforcement, telling the government, hey, we cannot do this on newer devices. Here are the ways we can help you. Here's what we can give you. Sometimes it's regarding what's put up onto the cloud or something like that. But they've laid out pretty clearly what they're able to do and what they're not able to do. And in this case, it seems like this falls squarely into the realm of those things which they are unable to do.
Okay, now, David, hold on. We've got a caller. Ken is on the line and has some very important information. So, Ken, what's on your mind?
Thank you. Dave, entirely correct. Under the new omnibus spending bill, which has already been passed, hidden under funding for refugees, Paul Ryan also pushed through cyber surveillance bill. I've forgotten the number of it, but it is cyber security.
Yep,
if you're
CISA.
Aware of that,
CISA. Mm-hmm.
Then you know that companies such as, and not limited to, Google and Apple are completely free from any civil lawsuit when they hand over private information to the government and in the text is without court orders or warrant. Now, the bill also allows law enforcement to use information obtained without warrants to lock people up on criminal charges, all hidden under cyber surveillance, which has nothing to do with protecting U.S. computer networks or industries, but uses the justification of the cybersecurity network to give better spying powers to both the FBI and the NSA. There's no accountability right here. And the thing I wanted to do to bring up to you and everyone else listening is that's why this issue is so thorny. We don't know what we don't even don't know.
Now, Kit, I want you to hold on for a moment because I want to ask a question, I guess, first of David and then have you comment on it, Ken. And that is, I find it interesting that Apple and Google were carved out, but say like Verizon or, you know, any of the phone companies, they weren't. Am I hearing that correctly?
Molly, I can't answer from my perspective. David, you may know more, but I do know that while Google and Apple are completely exempt from any civil lawsuit without and also without the they're not subject to warrant, the companies not listed, I do not have. The companies who make component parts, I do not have. I can't answer.
Let me jump in on this one. I do know that the topic, Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. The Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act is in a different vein than the information being discussed here, and I think it's an important difference that I want to explain here. What's being talked about the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act is largely the technical information, ones and zeros, that what is making up a malware. What, when you see a virus come across your computer, how do you report that information about here's a threat that I'm seeing on my network, and I want to tell other people about that threat. That way they don't fall for the same trick. That is what we're talking about when we're talking about the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. That information sharing process is one that, yeah, it is voluntary, so there's no warrant process because the companies have to voluntarily decide to give that information up. But like I said, the information being shared is of a nature that is, largely technical. However, you brought up that it could be used, for example, for law enforcement purposes. Well, for example, here's an example I like to use. Imagine that in the course of sharing information, we discovered that there's a bank vulnerability. It's a type of malware that's going after bank vaults, and it opens the bank vault doors for the robbers. Now, that's a cybersecurity problem, clearly, if you can open the bank vault doors, but it's also a real physical law enforcement issue, right? Someone is probably going to look to open a bank door sometime in the near future, and we need to have law enforcement be able to use that information to catch those robbers who are waiting. Maybe they're casing a bank as we speak. And so that's why there's the law enforcement's able to use that information the way they are. So that discussion about CISA and cybersecurity information sharing is slightly different than what we're talking about here, where what we're talking about is, can the FBI access a phone which is locked? And there's no doubt that the FBI should be able to access the information. They have a court order. They have a warrant. It's a terrorist phone. We know it's a terrorist phone. So it's a slightly different issue.
Okay. Now, David, it's Kim here. But with the Fourth Amendment, you know, I actually think it's important to err on the side of freedom and liberty. You know, I think there's the quote that if you have to decide between security and freedom, that if you choose security, eventually you'll have neither of them. So this, you know, with the Fourth Amendment, I think that is really important that law enforcement, that we not really be able to access all this information without a warrant. So with the NSA, a lot of that information is being accessed without a warrant. And you said something interesting. I thought you said they have to voluntarily, and have to involuntarily didn't seem to me like they should be in the same sentence. So, you know, this is complicated. Am I connecting any dots here, or tell me what you
sure.
think?
Sure. So, yeah, no. So, just a quick clarification on the have to voluntary, as in they do not have to share information at all. And if they do, the process by which they share that information is voluntary.
Okay, thank
so
you.
So it is not a forcing mechanism.
Okay, got it.
But I agree. And when we talk about information that is being shared, there's a certain there are protections through the Fourth Amendment that need to be protected. Like I said, in the case of CISA, this bill we're talking about here, it's not focused on personal information. It's focused primarily on these ones and zeros. It's primarily focused on these threat actors and the avenues they're using to attack our computers. In the terms of this Apple debate, I actually have just read Apple's response, or have quickly scanned Apple's response
because yeah, I
they're
did appealing too.
Yeah. this decision.
Mm-hmm.
They actually do not reference the Fourth Amendment. They make an article. They make a First Amendment and a Fifth Amendment argument, as well as some other arguments, but they actually don't reference the Fourth Amendment. And that's because in this case, in the Apple case, I think everyone recognizes that this phone, they have a proper warrant. They have the right to access the information on the phone. The question is, can they force Apple to create a new program to unlock that, to help them unlock the phone? That's really the crux of the issue here, is can they force Apple to do that, which, like I said, brings up First Amendment and Fifth Amendment issues. But at least that's what Apple's arguing, because Apple isn't even bringing up the Fourth Amendment. But that doesn't mean that we should, you know, get to the place where we are unlocking phones without the Fourth Amendment. Clearly, you need to have a proper warrant. You need to follow the proper adjudication steps to make sure that there's a reasonable suspicion that would justify the ordering of the unlocking of any phone and providing data to law enforcement through the proper channels.
Okay. David, Molly here. Do you mind telling us a little bit about the Patriot Act and what that would say about this kind of situation?
Sure. So the Patriot Act is one of these bills that has a lot of different provisions. So we could talk about, you know, many. So to talk about just the Patriot Act is actually quite difficult, because there's lots of different provisions that could apply. But the main two which we are discussing in the United States are Section 215 and Section 702. Real fast, Section 215, we actually had a debate about this last year, and there were some changes made to the law. And that regarded how the law enforcement and the intelligence community in the United States is able to get a hold of what's called metadata. That's basically the call records. So, this number, 555-5555 called 556-6666, something like that. They're able to recognize the who's calling who, and those connections are very important, because you can figure out sometimes a terrorist chain, or you figure out this guy's talking to a terrorist, you can put together the dots that way. Section 702 deals with communications abroad, what's going on with people who are not Americans, how we're gathering information on their information abroad. In this case, this is a case where I don't, the government has not invoked the Patriot Act at all, because they've actually invoked something from the 1700s, the All Writs Act of, I think it's 1789, I think. So the government's actually not invoking the Patriot Act here. They're invoking a far, far older statute, which is actually one of the things that Apple is contesting.
Okay, David, it's Kim here, and this is going to be really simple. So you'll understand just how good I am at technology here. But what I am seeing is we have a bad guy who mm-hmm. killed a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And the good guy, the government, wants to find out what's going on so that all the rest of us can be protected. So
yeah.
They go to the apartment owner and they say, we'd like to get into the apartment. And mm-hmm. the apartment owner says, well, I don't have a key. And they say, well, we want you to make us a key. And then he says, well, I can't make a key. I mean, is that too simplistic, or is that?
It's a little too simplistic. There are some examples, but for instance, in this case, because the FBI can still break down the door, they can still pick the lock. In this case, they can't pick the lock. They can't do it because of these protections. For example, one of the protections on the iPhones nowadays is that if you and we're not sure that this was enabled on this iPhone, but they don't want to take the risk. One of the protections on iPhones nowadays is that after 10 failed password attempts, the phone can be set to auto-erase. So everything on the phone just disappears. The FBI can't risk doing that. And so they can't, you know, they can't just break down the door. They can't pick the lock, because if they guess wrong 10 times, they could be completely out of luck. And so that's why this is a particularly hard case, and why the FBI, they've probably exhausted all those other options. They've asked, you know, hey, you know, do you know his password? Do you know what he might have said? There's also, I think,
right.
the local government may have even reset the password, so they don't even – there may be no one who even knows what the password is anymore. So this is a truly a case where the FBI has probably used every tool at its disposal. It failed, and now that's why they went to court.
Well, I'm confused, David. Molly here. So what information could they get off these phones if Apple were to do this? Because right now at this point – Apple could already easily give them all of the phone numbers that that they called and that they received, right? And they could probably, the FBI or the government could probably get access to the emails of the killers, because they could go to the internet service providers for that kind of thing, right? I mean, what is the big deal that they're really trying to get from Apple here?
So so there's the rub. They can definitely get phone communications, because those are available, or not communications. They can get the who called who. That's called the metadata, and you can get that from the phone company. The question about is more about stuff that information that could be the actual content. So we don't know some emails, certainly iMessages, so text messages, and other things that are on other actual content we might not be able to get, because that content is encrypted. As I mentioned earlier, properly encrypted information cannot be cracked, which means the person who owns the phone has a passcode, and that passcode is the key to the encryption. Without that key, it's just a bunch of gobbledygook that no one can read. That is the problem here, in that we can get some connections. You know, he called this person, this number called this person, but a lot of the content on the phone, a lot of the actually what are they saying in their text messages or whatnot, we can't get that. And that's ultimately what the FBI is after, because they're looking for, hey, are they mentioning, you know, maybe there's another plotter, maybe there's a name they mentioned in their iMessages or something like that. That's what they're after.
Okay. What about so when you say, I'm thinking voicemails. Now, I saved some voicemails on my phone. You know, my father passed away. I had some saved messages of my father. Mm-hmm. And I called my phone company and said, how can I keep these into perpetuity? And they did that for me. They pulled them for me specifically, put them on an MP3 and sent it to me so that I have those. So don't they don't need an encryption key? Or did Apple now do so much that they themselves can't even get in there and get those voicemails?
So I don't know about the voicemails. When I talk about iMessages, that's the Apple's fancy word for text messages.
Okay.
So text messages, certain emails, certain other things that basically we don't know also what's all on the device, because it's locked right now. So we also don't know all that could be on there. That's the thing, right? There could be nothing on there. The FBI doesn't know ultimately what's on the phone until they open it up. They just have reason to believe, and I think it's fair to assume, that there could be valuable information on that phone. Mm-hmm. But we don't know. In some cases, in similar cases in the past where the FBI has had Apple unlocked earlier phones, they've found information, and sometimes there's nothing.
Right.
But like I said, there's been a change in the security process. Older phones Apple could unlock. Newer phones it's become harder and harder for Apple to help in breaking down those passcodes. And then this current one, they can't do it unless they create a new program. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, David and Sarah, we are just coming up to the break here. How can people reach you or get your writings where can they find you?
Sure. Yeah, so you can find more information about me and the Heritage Foundation at www.heritage.org. We cover all sorts of issues and are currently definitely looking at this issue more in depth, because it's a constantly evolving issue.
Okay, and just one thing, I think.
I have one more question. I'm wondering, if you have time, is there any chance if we go to break that you could stay on? I have one more question just about that Writs Act. I'm not sure how much you know about it, but I'd love to know a little bit more about that if you have any.
I have a few. I'm not an expert in 18th century law, though, I must confess.
Well, why don't we go ahead and go to break, and when we come back, you can answer that question of Molly's. And David and Sarah with the Heritage Foundation, we really appreciate that, so we'll be right back. April 15th. You know what day that is. Leonardo da Vinci's birthday. He was born in Italy in 1452. Oh yeah, and it's tax day, the favorite day of socialists and the least liked day by hardworking Americans. It's important that you work with trusted individuals for all of your accounting needs and tax preparation. Hi, Kim Munson here. The Americhicks work with a truly professional accounting firm, Predovich & Company. The team at Predovich & Company can help with all of your accounting needs, individual, business, or nonprofit. Give them a call at 303-791-3000 or check out their website at dpredovich.com. That's dpredovich.com. And be sure and tell them the Americhick sent you.
And when it's done, believe it, I will yell it from that
mountain. Hey, welcome back to the Heart of the Matter with the Americhicks, Molly and Kim. We're getting to the heart of the matter on the Apple versus the FBI case that's taking place right now. We've got David and Sarah on the phone, who is a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation and specializes in homeland security issues, including cyber and immigration policy. So we've been talking a little bit about this case and trying to figure out what rights the government has in this case. You know, can they force Apple to put together an encryption key to open up phones so that the government has access to information? And, you know, on the one hand, you think, well, I thought they kind of already had that right, through the Patriot Act and through trying to protect the people. Of course, we want to make sure they have a warrant to open up our phones and our computers and look at our stuff first, as the Fourth Amendment has guaranteed us that right to privacy. At the same time, we want to make sure that the government does have what they need in order to get the bad guys, because their job is to protect the people. So really quick. So David,
yep.
we were talking before the break about the Patriot Act and the Fourth Amendment being used by, you know, as cases for on Apple side and on the government side as to should they let them open up all of our stuff. And you said they're not quoting either of those. Apple is actually pulling from 1789 Judiciary Act, which was the All Writs Act.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us just a little bit, whatever you know about that. Why are they pulling from that one specifically, and what exactly does that mean?
Sure, yeah. So the government has made the argument that the All Writs Act applies here. And my understanding of the All Writs Act is that basically, like I said, it's one of the first laws, you know, the country would have passed back in the 1780s. This act would have been, is my understanding, is primarily used to help the government, you know, bring into force another act which they've already secured. So if they've secured a warrant somewhere else, they can use the All Writs Act to try to make sure that the warrant takes effect, as it were, to make sure that it sort of comes into effect, that they can get what they want. The problem here is that I think this is Apple's contention, is that you're requiring them to create an entirely new software tool to get at this information. And so the All Writs Act, while the All Writs Act is supposed to help law enforcement get at information, this is too far of an ask, especially since it's the only law that the government seems to be relying on, and it doesn't have anything else that it's arguing.
Okay. I saw something at an attorney just sent us a message and said that it's interesting that this All Writs Act was enacted actually the very same week that Congress passed the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, it was before the Fourth Amendment was you know, adopted by the states. So yeah, this law really is one of the first ones out there, and I think, as you can sort of tell, it was just designed to make sure, even before the Fourth Amendment occurred, it was designed to make sure that, you know, law enforcement could access information under certain conditions and with appropriate legal authority. But
okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, David and Sarah, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. This was just really helpful. So thank you so much, and you have a great week.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Thank you. And we have a caller. Tim Dietz is on the line. And Tim, you've got something to say regarding this whole issue, huh?
Well, I don't know if it's really something new to say. I heard this from David and Sarah from the Heritage Foundation briefly, and Apple has kind of hinted at it, but it doesn't look like this is their primary argument. is whether the government can coerce a technology company into putting engineering effort into developing something that doesn't previously exist. And as I was going, when I read Tim Cook's letter to the consumers, he didn't really argue that point other than to say that in order for Apple to comply with the FBI's request, they would have to develop an application and an operating system. And in my mind, having worked in the tech sector, I'm thinking that that's going to require a substantial amount of effort to do that.
Okay.
And so at least in my mind, separate from the security and privacy issues, which I think is a very legitimate concern, and it sounds like that's Apple's number one concern, secondary to that is who's going to pay for the effort to build the application and operating system to go out and do what the FBI wants.
Okay. So in essence here, Tim, do you think that it looks like the government, the FBI, is asking a private company to use their resources to do some detective work? Does that seem like...
It may be. I have not read the subpoena, so I don't have the details on what is in there. So I don't know if it's the FBI essentially demanding that it be produced or if the FBI is saying, hey, will you do this for us and partner with us to solve this problem? So I don't have those details. But it's not entirely clear to me on what that involves. But it certainly raises a question in my mind that, you know, if the FBI wanted to enter into a contract with a tech company to develop an application, they're certainly free to do that. I don't have the information in front of me, and I haven't read it to understand the scope on how the FBI has approached Apple to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, what I'm thinking is, does the government have the right to force a private company like this to use their resources to create a backdoor for them to spy on us? But, and I would say, no, they don't have that right. But we've seen with the passage of Obamacare and when the Supreme Court said, you know what? Yeah, the government does have the right to force private citizens to buy a product with their hard-earned money or else they're going to be penalized. So I'm seeing that the government's already forcing private citizens to spend our money to buy things they want us to buy. So I wouldn't see it being such a stretch for the government to say we have the right to force this private company, Apple, to create something and to build something and spend their own money and resources doing it for the better good.
Yeah,
it kind of scares me a little bit.
Yeah, I think so.
But since there's a precedent, right, since they've done that.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting question, but if we could, you know, look at it from the absurd, and this is a purely absurd example, is let's say every employee at Apple quit tomorrow, and the FBI says, Apple, you have to develop this application. We're going to coerce you to do that. Who's going to do the work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and who's going to pay for it? Where are they going to get the engineers? And like I say, it's an absurd example, but as a private citizen, I would be certainly concerned about the government coming in and telling me that I have to spend my time to develop something for the government when I need to be going out to pay the mortgage or the rent or buy groceries and put food on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. So, Tim, any last thoughts?
No, ma'am, I appreciate your time. And like I said on Facebook earlier, I'm not sure I had a whole lot to offer, but thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
We really appreciate it. That was a great call. Yeah. So now on that, we would like to play. Molly had a great question to former Congressman Pete Hoekstra from Michigan, who had been the he represented Michigan in Congress for 18 years, serving as the chairman of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee. He serves as the Shulman Senior Fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, the world's most comprehensive data center on radical Islamist terror. His specialties include national security, international relations, countering global Islamist terror, and cybersecurity. So the question, Molly, I think was, what should women be concerned about today? And with that, this is what Congressman Pete Hoekstra had to say.
Well, I think from a women's perspective, it's very important for them to understand the threat to their values here in the United States and in the Western world from radical jihadist Islam. You take a look at how women are treated in Islamic countries, but especially if you take a look at how women are treated under ISIS. They're basically treated as property. They are auctioned off as sex slaves. They are second-class citizens. And you say, well, that's the Middle East, that's ISIS. And it's kind of like, no, that's now a bigger portion of the Middle East. It's going into Northern Africa. It's poised to move into Western Europe. And the last thing that you want to do is you fought so long and so hard for the rights that you rightfully have that you need to be in a position to protect them. And this movement is a real danger to American values and how we treat women, how we treat gays and lesbians, how we treat our children. And this is a real threat that's out there that you ought to be interested in.
Well, Molly, former Congressman Pete Hoekstra, and he knows what he's talking about because he has been the chairman of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee. And you continue to bring this issue up, which I think is really important. And I'm just sitting here scratching my head. He's right that women have worked hard to secure a number of rights. And this idea that there is this ideology that does not honor women or gays or lesbians or, you know, anyone that they see that looks at things differently from them is a real danger to us. Now, you know, as you look out the window and you see people, you know, driving their cars, living their lives safely, this doesn't seem like it could be a real danger, but my heart is restless. I think it is a real danger, Molly. I think that it's lurking just under the surface here. And I think that we have to be very concerned about it.
We do. I think we definitely do. And I keep asking this question to as many people who either are currently serving in office in Washington, D.C. right now or, you know, recently have or that serve on some sort of a, you know, boards and that are paying attention to foreign events, foreign policy, foreign security. And I keep asking my military friends, what do we really need to know? What's going on? I understand that in order to protect us, the government shouldn't be telling us 100% everything that's going on, right? I mean, they've got to have that element of surprise so that they can protect us. But when I ask people like Pete Hoekstra and you know, we saw Congressman Ken Buck and we saw Kaufman this weekend, and just asking them, what's going on? Are we safe? I'm hearing unanimous no, mm-hmm. We're not safe. And I'm saying, is the government doing everything they can to protect us? No, they're not. And I say, okay, what about these refugees? We're America. We can get background information on anybody we want. We are vetting these guys. We know who's coming into our country. And they say, no, we're not. The UN is vetting them. There's no information on these guys. They don't have background paperwork. You don't know what they've done before. You don't know where they come from. And so I'm so concerned that people are listening to talking points and saying, we need to care about everybody and help them and bring them into our country. And I agree we want to help people. And you know what? People, they do what they can to get to America. They risk their lives to come here because they're safe here. But if we're no longer protecting the people and the government isn't vetting who's coming over our borders, then we're no longer going to be that, you know, shiny city on a hill that people can come to. We're not going to be a free, safe country any longer. So I'm concerned about it. That's why I keep asking the questions. And I just encourage our listeners, keep asking the questions. Mm-hmm. Call your congressman. I know politics is boring. I know it takes time, but do it. Let them know that you do care, that you care about your children, you care about your neighbors, you care about society here. You know, we're not racist people. We're not judging people on anything other than the content of their character and their intentions in America. And we have seen, we've seen the articles, we see what's going on in Germany and Austria and Sweden, and what's happening is the refugees that are coming from second and third world countries, don't believe in freedom, don't believe in women's rights, don't believe in homosexual rights, don't believe in freedom of speech, and don't believe in freedom of religion. And they will use force and terror to get rid of our rights.
Well, the important point there is that we are a compassionate people. We are a people that we come from all different corners of the world. But we are not able to vet these refugees appropriately. And we're not assimilating. You know, instead it's becoming, you know, a community of X or a community of X instead of assimilating. But I'm actually concerned we're not even assimilating our kids through the education system anymore. You know, all of these things need to understand the special vision of what America is. And it's radical, this idea that the individual would have rights instead of the collective. But Molly, I'm seeing a movement to try to put forth rules and regulations and taxes and all kinds of things for the collective instead of the individual. I believe that we are at a very important time in our country. And we've been somewhat asleep at the wheel as in education, in our churches, in immigration. All of these things have come in to really dilute the American idea. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, if America is no longer America, the world will be less safe, the world will be less free, there will be less opportunity, you know, women, children will be hurt. And so we have a responsibility, each and every citizen, to be engaged, to be informed, and to make sure that we understand the issues, that we understand the candidates. And, you know, nobody's going to be perfect. There's never going to be one person that you're going to agree with 100%. The only person will be yourself.
not even all the time there. Yeah.
But we need to be engaged, and we need to make sure that we hold each other accountable, that we hold our office holders accountable, and we need to make sure that when people are coming to America, that they want to be American. Not that they want to hurt Americans.
Right, right. Well, and as since we are talking a little bit about that threat to women and to all people in America, one thing that I'm concerned about, too, is Cuba, Gitmo. President Obama has been talking about closing Gitmo, and he just continues to release these really, really, really bad guys back out into onto the fighting field.
Right.
To come after us again.
They've caught a number of them.
They've caught so many.
Back.
And they're letting them go. And we're finding out that these guys are returning to the fight of terror against the Western world, against Americans, against freedom. And Obama is going to Cuba. And I've heard some concerns from some friends of mine that said they're worried that Obama may give Gitmo to the Cubans. So they give our military base to Cuba. If he closes it completely and literally then hands it over. And then people have said, well, so what happens then? What happens? Cuba has Gitmo. Okay, fine. They have a military base that now they can use of their own. So what? So they say, so then what if they sell to the highest bidder? Well, then who is going to be the highest bidder? I would think maybe Russia, North Korea. I mean, we know that there are some people out there that want to hurt us. And that concerns me.
That's a big concern.
It's a big concern. So next week, I have invited Peter Brooks from the Heritage Foundation to come on and talk to us a little bit more about that specifically. So I just wanted to ask people, do some research, come up with your questions, and then tune in next Thursday as we talk about that. And I definitely want to know your questions. So let us know on our Facebook page or our Gmail.
Yeah. And with regarding Gitmo, I know that our senators have stood up and said that we are not interested in having these prisoners come to Colorado. And, of course, we went down to Canyon City, and over 130 people showed up. We did a videotaping that they say the Gitmo prisoners should remain in Gitmo. Mm-hmm. And it is a campaign promise that President Obama had given, and he's trying to make good on that. But once again, I don't see how he's trying to protect the American people. And that is one of the first things, one of the first responsibilities that he has, Molly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it just seems like national security is becoming number one on so many people's radars.
It is.
Because of what's taking place right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, why in the world is our government not protecting us?
Well,
why would they let these bad guys go anywhere? Second, why would they think of bringing the bad guys here to America, which is where they want to be in the first place, because we're the ones that they need to destroy if they're going to, you know, take over the world as their plan is. See, why is Obama saying we're going to now extend the number of diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, that we allow into America over our borders?
Yeah, just explain that, because I think you talked about that in the first hour.
Oh, sorry. So I did talk about that in the first hour. But the HHS has just, the Health and Human Services has just come out and said that, you know, President Obama is now saying let's make a change. We've got more people that are coming over the border with these sexually transmitted diseases. Let's declassify some of them because they're not really big deals in America anyway. They shouldn't have been on the list. So we shouldn't even worry about people bringing these diseases over because they don't exist in America, which I'm saying, okay, yeah, they don't exist in America now because we have outlawed people coming over with these diseases from second and third world countries who do have these diseases right now. And the other thing is they said they are also going to start pumping at least $100 million into the budget each year to start treating some of the biggest STDs mm-hmm. for the immigrants that are coming over our border. Mm-hmm. So they're admitting that they're going to need to be treating people, but they're reducing the types of diseases that they're going to treat. Because they're saying they're not a big deal, they're not rampant. And the only reason they're saying they're not a big deal isn't because they don't kill us, but because they're not prevalent in America now. So I'm really concerned about that. I would love doctors, any OB-GYNs out there, any doctors that have an opinion on this, please call or write us because I want to know what you think. Am I just freaking out over for no reason, or is this a big deal that President Obama wants to allow more people into our country with sexually transmitted diseases, knowing that a lot of the people that they're bringing into this country believe that raping a woman is okay and that is within their rights?
Yeah. And with that, Molly, thinking about the money, you know, there's all kinds of different projects that are being brought before the American people that we don't have enough money for, fill in the blank, roads and bridges, Social Security, you fill in the blank. So if we don't have enough money to do the things that we're supposed to do to take care of our citizens, why on earth would we redefine, although this administration does a lot of redefining what the term STD is, and then that will require $100 million. I mean, you can certainly do some roads and bridges for $100 million, right?
Every year, $100 million, every year, yes.
Yeah. And so it seems that on one hand, you have politicians and bureaucrats that say that we care about people, but yet when you really look at what they're doing, which you mentioned earlier today, people need to really look under the hood and see what's going on. What they say and what they're doing is two different things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a few other things I wanted to point people to our website to see. We talked about it in the first hour, but not in the second hour. Kim was just named the Leadership Program of the Rockies Leader in Action.
Thank you.
For 2016. So congratulations, Kim.
Big honor.
And that was a big honor in itself. The really cool thing, I think, also, though, is that Tommy Lauren has done a video talking about Kim on The Blaze, and that's on our website and on our Facebook as well. So check that out. But we're also going to be including videos of the different interviews that we had while we were down at the Leadership Program of the Rockies. And you're going to like some of these guys. Like Charlie Kirk is one guy. He's 22 years old right now. He's the founder of Turning Point USA. And this is a group of millennials, 20-something-year-olds, that are going around and talking at different college campuses about capitalism versus socialism. And it seems like they've really done a great job in getting people to start, the students there, to start thinking about what socialism actually means. And just a teaser here, but go listen to it. Go to our website to listen to the full interview. But he said, the interesting thing is when we ask kids, are you for socialism? They say yes. But if you ask them, are you for the government controlling more, having more control over your life or less control over your life? And they said, no, we don't want the government to have control over their life, but they're for socialism. So he's like, okay, why is socialism a positive in your mind? And he said that many college students equate the word socialism to social media.
Which, that's astounding to me that a college student wouldn't know the difference.
Which shocks me, because the word is just a positive word. Socialism's a positive word because it's like social media, and we do Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and all this stuff, so it's good. Yeah, but no, it's not. He said, so, the good thing is start asking the question a different way. Ask, do you trust the government? Do you want more or less freedom? And do you trust what the government tells you when they promise you stuff? Most people are going to say no to that. And if you say no to that, then that means you don't want socialism, so you shouldn't be feeling the burn and voting for Bernie Sanders. If that was your first pick, please go back to the drawing board and do a little bit more research, because if you think that a government that can give you everything can take everything away, you're right. Don't give them that power.
Well, absolutely. And when you talk about Facebook and Twitter and all these, it wasn't socialism that brought those forward into people's lives.
Absolutely
not. It was capitalism, the ideas of creativity and innovation and individuals being able to provide a product or a service that people are willing to freely give their money for, to trade for that. Mm-hmm. And I know that millennials love all those things. Mm-hmm. So with that, Molly, though, we had talked with David and Sarah from the Heritage Foundation regarding the whole Apple FBI thing. And I thought, you know, it might be important. We talked about the Fourth Amendment, that people hear what Madison had to say when he wrote the Fourth Amendment, because they didn't want government to just be able to snoop around on everybody. There had to be a reason. So the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. This is very, very important for us to remain free.
Yes, it is. And we want to remain free. We want to make sure that the government can't just knock down your door and walk right inside and check out your home. And so you want to make sure that we are holding the government accountable. And when somebody comes to your door and says, let me come in and check out, if a policeman comes to your door and says, let me come in and check out your house, you have a right to ask for a warrant.
And respectfully. Yeah, respectfully. Yeah.
Respectfully.
Yeah, we certainly want to be respectful with our police officers. However, we also want to make sure that we understand what our rights are. And, you know, and whether or not it's our computer or, you know, or any of our other of our papers, they all need to be protected under the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, that's right. Tune in next week. We're going to talk about Obama's visit to Cuba. We're also going to talk about the new Pay Equity Act they're trying to pass here in Colorado. So this is the Mayor Chick signing off. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next Thursday.